any size. Can't you see? Just like guys, look out. Here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead. Hey there, there goes the Spider-Man. In the chill of night, at the scene of a crime, like a streak of light, he arrives just in time. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Welcome fame, he's ignored. Action is his reward to him. Life is a great big bang, wherever there's a hang, you'll find a Spider-Man.
Coming to you from occupied France, where the men of Easy Company fight an eternal war beneath the steely gaze of Sergeant Rock, this is the 11th Long Box Graveyard Podcast. Thank you for downloading and listening. My name is Paul O'Connor, and for the next 2 hours or so, I will be your host for an interview with Mark Giannacchio of the Chasing Amazing blog, where we will run down Mark's choices for the top 10 all-time issues of The Amazing Spider-Man. Mark is a Spider-Man authority, but more importantly, his blog is about what Spider-Man has meant to him throughout his life, which is right in the wheelhouse for Long Box Graveyard, and I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. It's a long show this month, so I'm going to skip a detailed rundown of the goings-on at my blog. Safe to say that you should check out www.longboxgraveyard.com if you'd like to read some groovy articles about Frank Frazetta's Fire and Ice, The Last Days of Superman, as told by Alan Moore and Grant Morrison, a look at Roy Thomas and Frank Thorne's Red Sonja, a debate about how best to pronounce Submariner, or Submariner, as you like, a look at the original Guardians of the Galaxy of the 60s and 70s, and even a gallery of Johnny Storm shouting, "Flame on!" And you'll also find a guest column by my interview subject tonight, Mark Giannacchio of Chasing Amazing, where he runs down the top 10 Spider-Man battles of all time. It's there for you to enjoy at www.longboxgraveyard.com. Something for everyone. And so without further ado, let's get to Mark's interview. And please stick around after the interview for my plug of the month and also a special bulletin about the future of the Long Box Graveyard podcast. And now, here is my interview with Mark Giannacchio of Chasing Amazing blog, the top 10 single issues of Amazing Spider-Man. All right, I am joined on the phone today by Mark Giannacchio, who is the master of the Chasing Amazing blog, where he chronicles his attempt to own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man. How you doing, Mark?
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thanks for joining us today at the Long Box Graveyard Podcast. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Mark, your background, and what led you to this peculiar obsession with The Amazing Spider-Man?
Oh, absolutely, Paul. Well, my website is Chasing Amazing, as you say it, and the site basically chronicles my quest issue by issue to get through all 700 issues of Amazing Spider-Man, going back to issue number one. The site posts about twice a week. There's usually kind of a retro post where I reflect upon an issue from the past, and then, you know, to kind of cater to contemporary readers, we talk about the new issues that come out. There's a lot of similarities with what you're doing over at Long Box, but, you know, also a couple of little things that are a little bit different. Basically the whole idea for this came from, I first started reading comic books when I was about 7 years old in the late 80s. And the first comic book that I bought for myself with, you know, my little monthly, weekly allowance I got from my parents was a copy of Amazing Spider-Man 296 off the spinner rack at the little candy store, smoke shop, down the street from my parents' house. And I was just totally captivated by the character. You hear a lot of people always talk about the relatability of Peter Parker, the everyman, the Parker luck, that, the trouble that he's always getting into, the lack of social life, the whole thing. And I just really was drawn to this character. And as time moved on, I started to become interested in some of the back issues. I bought a couple of Silver Age issues with some money I had saved up from, you know, like from Christmases and other holidays. And, you know, that's when I started to realize that, you know, I had started the collection, whether I realized it or not. And, you know, when I was maybe a teenager, I used to joke with my friends like, oh, you know, one day I'll own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man. Like, yeah, sure. Okay. Well, where are you going to get that money from? And as time gone on, you know, bit by bit, was getting closer and closer. There was one moment when I was in college where through a friend of my girlfriend, now my wife, I got a huge long box of issues, you know, for a song. And that really propelled my collection forward. And beyond that, you know, the other character in all this, you know, Mrs. Chasing Amazing, is her support through this whole thing. You know, I guess you always hear about, you know, significant others when it comes to people with collections, you know, are they going to be there to support it? And my wife always, you know, was there. And, you know, she, you know, some of my prized issues she bought for me as gifts for birthdays or anniversaries or whatever. And she's also the one who a couple of years ago said, you know, you should blog about what you're doing. You know, like this is a very unique thing. You have unique opinions on the topic. You know, you kind of have these little reminiscences that I almost call them like my Proustian Madeline, you know, Madelines about these issues from the past and how I acquired them and what they mean to me and where I was in my life where I got them. You know, you should start writing about that. And that's where Chasing Amazing was born. And, you know, I've been doing it ever since, with a couple of breaks here and there. My now 16-month-old son was born in November 2011. So missed some time with that and missed a little bit of time last summer as I guess I was gearing up for the big shocking events of Amazing Spider-Man 700, but, you know, have been cruising along ever since. And, you know, it's just a joy to both discover the new material and then go back and, you know, share old experiences and having readers like you and others who come on the site and just share these wonderful thoughts about what these comic books mean to them and, you know, how it connects to their lives as well.
Well, I'd say your wife sounds like a keeper, Mark.
so actively no question. Support you. And if she's listening, definitely.
That's great. I mean, to so actively support you in your hobby and also to purchase these comics for you on birthdays and anniversaries is tremendous. And, you know, and also to encourage you to create your blog, which certainly I'm attracted to, have been attracted to, have been a loyal reader for about a year now, I think. In fact, I think the first time I read your blog is right about when you were going to go on hiatus because your son was coming and you were wondering, you know, what does this mean for my blogging, for my collecting going forward? What I admire about your blog, what I most enjoy about it, is it's not just about comics. It's about life. It's the lens of comics. That's the things that interest me. That's certainly the wheelhouse here for Longbox Graveyard. It makes you a kindred spirit.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, I mean, it's... You know, I guess it's my academia that's hard to kick sometimes where I make the comparisons that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Proust's remembrance of things past. You know, I call the remembrance of comics past. It's not just always about the comic itself. It's the experience and the memory that it brings forth. And sometimes the memory has nothing to do with the contents of the comic. I mean, sometimes the cover brings a memory. Sometimes the smell of a comic book brings something. And it just so happens that, you know, my collection is focused on Spider-Man, but I mean, you know, these sense memories and these, you know, nostalgic, you know, reminiscing, I mean, this could apply to anything, really.
Yeah, but you picked an especially good character, I think, to be the backbone of your collection. You mentioned Spider-Man's relatability and how that struck you, you know, reading that first issue, number 296. You know, 296, what was that, 20, 25 years after Amazing Spider-Man number one? But that basic DNA that was built into the character by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko was still on display. That insecure teenager, all the changes he'd been through in the preceding decades, that essential core of the character still spoke to you all those years later.
Yeah, and what's actually interesting is, I mean, that was the period where he had just gotten married to Mary Jane, so I guess things were starting to break a little bit better. But I still remember, I'm you know, of course, it's escaping me in this exact moment, but it was either 296 or 297, which was the second issue that I had bought. The opening splash page is, you know, Spider-Man in his black suit at the time, and he's out of web fluid, and he's getting rained on, and he's like, you know, like shivering in the cold, walking along the street as like Doc Ock is, you know, causing terror down the block. And I'm just saying, you know, what kind of superhero runs out of the substance that makes him go? And that's, I mean, that there's your Parker luck right there. I mean, so even in those moments where things were supposedly maybe turning for the better for Peter Parker, you know, that was a very early introduction was his case of ill timing and bad luck.
Well, you know, I'm glad you're going to talk about Spider-Man on the podcast tonight, and also that you've done a two-part blog for Longbox Graveyard where you've looked at your top 10 favorite Spider-Man battles, because I've been remiss in covering Spider-Man at the blog, and a lot of that has been due to when I came to the character for the first time, when I started reading comics in the 70s. It was not an especially stellar episode or era, I think, for the character. It was the Jerry Conway and Ross Andrew era that, for me, seemed very steeped in continuity of the wrong kind. It gave me the sense that Spider-Man's best years were behind him and that there weren't any great new stories for me to experience with this character. And I kind of bounced off the side of Spider-Man and never really went back to him. So those core elements that you just described, you know, his insecurity, his, you know, his Parker luck, as you describe it, running out of web fluid, et cetera, that those things were able to shine through despite maybe an awkward time in the character dramatically where maybe he's married and he's maybe divorced from the roots that make him more relatable to a young man. That tells me that you were able to come on board at a time Spider-Man was, well, certainly better than when I first encountered the character.
Your period did have the Spider-Mobile, I believe.
Yeah.
Which that got ditched quickly. And,
yeah,
and of course,
I had
there was the broken marriage of Aunt May and Doc Ock, which, you know, but yeah, I'll be honest, when I've gone on Longbox, I've always been like, it's not a Spider-Man on here. And then I realized, you know, when we talk about what's your wheelhouse, there's not a lot to write about in that era. I mean, I don't write a lot about that era, you know, in terms of, cause there's very few of those issues I have fond memories about acquiring. You know, there's the death of Gwen Stacy and the follow-up with the Goblin, and then there's the first Punisher. And then there's just a lot of nothing.
Some tough sledding. But, you know, in any character that's been around now for, you know, 50 years, there's going to be some ups and downs. There's going to be some issues that are better than others. And what we're going to talk about this evening are your 10 favorite issues of Spider-Man. You wrote this at your blog in a series of parts in the run-up to Amazing Spider-Man number 700, where you identified what you thought were your 10 favorite issues of Amazing Spider-Man. So I thought we'd use that as the backbone of our discussion and just go down your list and encourage readers that want more detail on any of these issues to go to Mark's blog, which you can find at www.chasingamazing.com. Did I get that correct, Mark?
It's actually chasingamazingblog.com. Apparently someone stole that domain. I was just Chasing Amazing underneath me. So, chasingamazingblog.com.
All right, accept no substitutes. Go to chasingamazingblog.com and let's drive that other clown off the internet in favor of my favorite Spider-Man blog. So chasingamazingblog.com, you did a series of blogs in the run-up to the release of Amazing Spider-Man number 700, which was the last issue of Amazing Spider-Man. It's been now replaced by Superior Spider-Man. Is that right?
Last issue, allegedly, and until they get far enough along with Superior where they realize they can just recontinue numbering and go to 800. But
oh,
you know,
jaded comic book
fan. No one in Marvel will ever tell you that. But
no, they wouldn't take advantage of readers this way. I mean, when Peter Parker is killed, he's dead, right? He's not coming back.
Well, he's astral Peter. He floats above the body of, you know, his former body. I don't know, however you want to put it. It's very, very sci-fi, and it kind of makes sense considering, you know, where Dan Slott's inspirations come from as a writer. And you know, there was a lot of outrage when the issue initially dropped. And I mean, I got to tell you, I mean, if you look at it as just one big arc, where, you know, you're under the impression inevitably Peter is going to, you know, be victorious at some point, whether it's 10 issues, 20 issues, 50 issues, whatever. It's actually pretty entertaining. I've been enjoying the new material. I mean, you know, there's always that kind of hesitance where It's like, this is unfamiliar. This is uncomfortable for me, but it's been a fun time since they started doing it.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, if ever there was a guy that had earned the right to step off the Spider-Man train, it would be you. Following it as closely as you have and getting to issue 700, that would have provided an out point for you, possibly. And I know you were contemplating that, but it sounds like you've recommitted to the character and you're still engaged.
Yeah, I mean, my thing was, as long as they kept telling interesting stories, I would stick with it. And you know, I mean, there are some things that I've, you know, been able to step away from in terms of like other series that I've read or not really collected, but just kind of invested some time into. But this one, I mean, like, Marvel has done some pretty heinous things to Spider-Man over the last 50 years. This is actually pretty low, I think, on the awful scale. I mean, you know, I mean the Clone Saga from the 90s, which you hear people talk a lot about. I mean, that actually got me off of comic books pretty, you know, for a couple of years, because I just couldn't keep up with it anymore. It was just making my head spin. Yeah. So no, there are no Clone Saga issues in my countdown. But this is like, you know, the stories are good. You know, it's you know, an interesting perspective on, you know, what does the villain do in the hero's body when the villain is actually trying to redeem himself? And I think that's where, you know, there's a creative license to tell some interesting things. But yeah, I did contemplate initially, you know, leading up, and that's part of the reason why I did this list. I it was kind of almost not that I was mourning Amazing Spider-Man, but I was, you know, kind of gearing up, like, you know, if this is it, let me at least look back on the positive memories. And unfortunately, you know, it's still been okay. And we have this list now that, you know, I can still look back on and still have those positive memories. So it's best of both worlds.
Well, that's good. And, you know, one of the issues I grapple with both at the blog and here on the podcast are these issues about collection and obsession about collecting things and about completeness, you know, having to have a complete set of something. And whether it's a healthy thing, whether it drives us, I don't think that it's a problem as long as it's what you know, thoroughly enjoy and want to do. And it seems to me that you've really examined your interest in the character and, you know, you're sticking with it and continuing to collect and read and enjoy Spider-Man, not because you feel like you have to, but because you really continue to enjoy the character.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, if I didn't want to do it, I wouldn't be doing it. It's really that simple. And I could certainly just be focusing on those remaining five issues that I'm trying to track down that just have eluded me for both cost reasons and just availability too. Although I guess if you go on eBay, you could always find something, but, you know, I don't know if I want to pay for a CGC 9.8 of, you know, the first Wizard for $30,000. probably not in my budget right now, you know.
Well, why don't you tell us real quickly, and before we get to your list here, which five issues are you still seeking in the event that an anonymous and wealthy listener of the Long Box Graveyard podcast wants to make your day? which issues are you looking for right now?
Sure, I'll put it out there and we'll see. No, it's issue 16, which is a Daredevil crossover, and I think that's part of the reason that's always been tough to find. I think because you got the Daredevil fans that are tracking that one too. There's issue 6, which is the first Lizard. Issue 4, which is the first Sandman. Issue 3, which is the first Doc Ock, and let me tell you, since Superior has launched, you just can't find that issue anywhere. You can't even find the insanely priced issues on eBay right now. Like, it's just people are hoarding it, probably, you know, thinking if things become really permanent with this story twist, they now officially have the first Superior Spider-Man appearance in addition to the first Doc Ock. And then of course issue 1, which you know, I've actually talked with people about this. They said, you know, since you've gone this long without getting a copy, we'll issue one, just be the last one you could get. And a part of me thinks it just needs to be, even, you know, unless someone, you know, that anonymous wealthy person listening to this podcast sends me something in the mail randomly and it's an issue one, I just think that I have my little issue one fund that I don't, you know, in my undisclosed location where I'm squirreling stuff away. But again, the plan is once the others are in tow, I will then, you know, cash in, so to speak, and get my issue one.
Gosh, that's, there's a part of me that thinks maybe you should never get it, that you should get everything else and keep the collection perpetually incomplete.
Yeah, right. I guess the catch though is I don't include annuals in the hunt because of very obscure and silly personal reasons. My plan is at some point to buy the annuals, but there are people who say, well, you know, how can you consider yourself having the whole thing if you don't have the annuals? I'm like, well, the annuals aren't part of the same numerical continuity. And they're like, no, that's stupid. But I'm like, then do you have to include one shots and crossovers and things like that? Because then I just think it becomes a slippery slope. So I guess, you know, that could always be the incomplete factor. And then of course there's Amazing Fantasy 15, the actual first appearance of Spider-Man, which, yeah, I just don't know if I will ever have the financial resources to find an acceptable looking copy of that. And, you know, there will be people out there who will tell me, well, how do you have a complete run of Spider-Man if you don't have his first appearance? And to that I'll say, well, you know what, then that will just have to be the missing link.
It's the necessary flaw in an otherwise perfect experience.
Exactly.
Well, you know, perhaps someday, let's just say someday, you know, and you have a son that's going to inherit this collection someday, and, maybe he'll be the one that completes the quest for you. Who knows?
There you go. I mean, that would be very poetic. But I'm not planning on selling any of these, so they're around. And the other thing I tell people is, you know, it's taken me 25 years, give or take, to get to this point. I can certainly wait longer before we get there. You know, I got nothing but time. And people tell me, well, the things are going to become more expensive. Well, you know what? Then they're more expensive. But you know, it's not about, you know, running fast to get this, because then, you know, I'm hoping for it to accrue and then I can flip it for something else. I mean, it's a conquest. There's no other way to put it, you know, and, you know, we'll get there maybe, or, you know, maybe we won't, but we're enjoying it all the same.
Excellent. Well, let's get to your list, Mark. We'll go in reverse order from number 10 to number 1 for a little suspense. And this, like all great top 10 lists, is it's not intended to be the top 10 greatest of all time. It's your top 10 favorites, right? I mean, it's an idiosyncratic list in that it represents your feelings and your desires about the character rather than some sort of objective measure of these are absolutely positively the 10 best issues ever made.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, the thing is that there are some issues in the list that people are going to be like, oh, well, you know, that's a very famous issue that totally belongs there. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I picked these 10 based on personal connection. I mean, the top two, without doing any spoilers, I mean, the reason why they're my top two is because my acquisition of them and just my personal relationship with them is very, you know, very personal to me. And I guess there are other people who might have, you know, a fondness for these issues, but mine is kind of transcends just general fondness. And then went through these other issues. It was comics that I feel defined the character that defined why I love the character. I mean, it's you know, not someone else's definition of the character, but you know, how I understand him.
Well, a good list should have a little controversy in it. It should make people angry. It should make people write in and say, how can you omit this favored issue or this favored character? And I think a lot of your picks are right down Main Street, but some are quite provocative, and I especially your top couple picks. But we'll get to those in due time. Let's start with number 10. Which is Amazing Spider-Man.
And number 10 is a famous story, and this is probably an issue that would be towards the top of some lists because of it. But It's Amazing Spider-Man 230,
okay,
which is the second part of the Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut arc from the mid-80s that was written by Roger Stern, who and art by John Romita Jr., the child of my favorite Spider-Man artist, for what it's worth. Roger Stern is, I mean, I know he had some great runs on the Avengers and was he on Captain America 2 or
yeah.
was, I'm trying to think here. Mm-hmm. I know you're a big Cap guy, so I'm just
yeah,
trying
to
remember.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of some of Marvel's better books of the late 70s into the early 80s. That was really Stern's time.
Yeah, I mean, Stern's run on ASM, I mean, he essentially revived the character from the doldrum period that you know him from. And his Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut arc is very famous because, you know, we have Juggernaut, X-Men villain. He is, you know, basically running through New York. He's trying to capture Madame Web, who is this kind of, you know, paranormal entity in the Spider-Man universe. And, you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, it's someone personal to Spider-Man that's in danger. And, you know, the X-Men are out of town. The Fantastic Four are out of town. The Avengers are probably in space. They're doing something. And it's just up to Spider-Man. And what I've always said about this arc and this issue specifically is, you know, the catchphrase for Juggernaut is nothing can stop the Juggernaut. He's the unstoppable foe. And, you know, with Spider-Man, it's always about the fact that even when the odds are against him, his spirit is always unbreakable. Spider-Man never backs down. He never runs from a fight. He is almost always routinely ready to just, you know, let, you know, put his entire body on the line if it means he can save something. Like, it's just, you know, to a point of recklessness. And this issue, this really captures that because, you know, he's just throwing everything a Juggernaut and, you know, with no success. And what ultimately ends up happening is he uses his intellect. And, you know, you got to keep in mind that, you know, Peter Parker is this scientific genius, not on the level of Reed Richards, but, you know, certainly very smart individual. And he basically tricks Juggernaut into falling into a vat of cement, of wet cement, which then hardens and traps him. And of course, even then, he doesn't actually succeed in beating him. I mean, it just subdues him to the point where he can, you know, save his friend and you know, let Juggernaut get out, you know, 5 or 6 hours later once he's able to work his way through the cement. But, I mean, it's you know, so, like, even in victory, it's not a total victory, but, you know, from the Spider-Man standpoint, it's like, oh, I can't believe he did this and he figured this out. And Stern just, like, nails those notes throughout with, I mean, both these issues, but I picked 230 over the preceding issue just because, I mean, that's really where the fight culminates. That's where, you know, he uses his brain to kind of, you know, at least subdue him to the point where he can save the day in his own way. And, you know, if there's ever an issue that demonstrates, you know, that unbreakable spirit, this is the one.
Well, they're very tight issues. I went and read this series about a year ago after you mentioned it at your blog. It's a terrific, it's a lot of action. It's a very visual story. And it is that irresistible force versus immovable object story. And I know this plays very well in your top 10 Spider-Man fights blog that you're doing at Longbox Graveyard as well. But what I think what shines out in your description about is this idea about Spider-Man not giving up, his indomitable spirit. That's a point you return to a number of times in your blog and in the issues that we're discussing this evening.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's like a lot of people who probably collect comic books, you know, I was not always the cool kid in school, so to speak. So you know, to have a character like this who kind of just perseveres at all costs, I mean, it's inspiring. And you know, I actually didn't read this comic for the first time until, I mean, years after it came out. I mean, it came out a couple years before I actually started. Before I started reading comic books, certainly, and it you know, I just remember reading it, and you know, maybe when I'm like in late in high school or early college or something, I was like, oh, I'm, you know, if I knew about this then, I probably would be, you know, it would have been even more inspiring to me. As it is, it was just kind of like, you know, great to look back and be like, you know, this character can just overcome these odds and not back down from a fight, and you know, and you know, I guess those are just things that you know, lessons and that you hope that you can pass on to you know, your children and all that, and your family.
Well, I think it's acknowledged as a classic, at least a minor classic issue by most comic fans. So that's Amazing Spider-Man number 230 and the preceding issue number 229, coming in at number 10 on your list. Now, number 9, I think, is a little more controversial. What do you have at number 9?
Okay, yeah, number 9, I picked Amazing Spider-Man 347, which is from the early 90s. It's written by David Michelinie with pencils by Eric Larson, who's, you know, part of that Image Revolution crew. And yeah, the reason why I picked this issue, it is a Spider-Man Venom arc. It's the second part of a two-part arc. It's kind of, you know, Venom captures Spider-Man, knocks him out, and brings him to his like little island paradise of just, you know, torture and violence. And you know, the Venom character has become very played out over the years, just because, you know, in large part because of these stories. I mean, in the beginning, you know, this Venom character was so cool. He had all of Spider-Man's attributes, but you know, because he had possession of the black symbiote alien suit, he, you know, it was, and on this very mentally deranged individual, it was like, you know, the doppelganger, you know, Bizarro Spider-Man, basically, for you know, I guess to make the Superman analogy. And but what I liked about this issue is I grew up in the beginning of the Venom era. Venom was very significant. He'll play a role later in this list. He really was the first major villain that was introduced when I was reading. And you know, this was before Symbiote Mania, where, you know, you had Carnage and Toxin and all these other characters. I had someone on Twitter recently correct me because I made some joke about, you know, how many symbiotes are there, and they told me the exact number. So there are people who are very heavily invested in this. But 347, it's fascinating. But 347 kind of it actually wraps up this kind of ongoing arc between Spider-Man and Venom that had been in fits and starts since Venom's first appearance in Amazing Spider-Man 300. And if this actually was the ending, it was so satisfying an ending. And that's why I liked it so much, because, you know, part of me just kind of wants to pretend that, you know, everything that came after and the oversaturation of the character didn't happen. Because in a vacuum, you know, what basically happens is to escape this island, Spider-Man fakes his own death. And it's the only way, you know, Venom finding what he believes is, you know, Spider-Man's skeleton with a suit on it. It's the only way that Venom basically stops pursuing him. And Venom has this very satisfied grin on one of the final pages as he's, you know, sitting on the island, basically like his fight is over. And then Peter is, you know, kind of like he swims out to this cruise liner, you know, out in the ocean, and he's staring back out towards the island, and he has a satisfied look. And it's like this feeling on both ends that it's over, you know, that, you know, Venom thinks he wins, Spider-Man thinks he won. And, you know, again, it would just be great if then, you know, 12 issues later, they didn't introduce Carnage, and then Maximum Carnage, and then, you know, 90s, you know, extravaganzas and gimmicks and stuff, and that really kind of beat the character into the ground. So, yeah, you know, it was kind of a nice, neat, tidy conclusion for a character that was really significant to me when I grew up reading.
The nature of the business, of course, is if something works once, do it twice. And if it works twice, do it another 5 or 10 times. It's easy to forget sometimes that these characters were young once, and that they were surprising, and that we didn't know what their what their fates or their potentials were going to be. And of course, contemporary books can reinvent brilliantly characters that have been around for 30, 40 years. The best writers do that continuously, but all too often we remember only that something's been beaten to death. It's that's why I laughed when you said that there's, you know, a fellow on Twitter that popped up and was able to give you an authoritative number of symbiotes that have spun off from Spider-Man. It's you know, these comics are published monthly. A character like Spider-Man is published more than monthly because he's starring in four or five different books at any given time. It's hard to stay fresh from month to month. But it sounds like, you know, in this case, at least, it was before the poor Venom was burned out and turned into a commodity or into an action figure.
Yeah, I mean, the joke with Venom towards the, you know, I guess the end of the 90s was, you know, all he did was talk about eating brains and, you know, with his tongue down to the floor, and they just kind of made him into a, you know, a zombie Spider-Man or something. And then that is what they did. And I don't know how they decided to go with, you know, just kind of a mentally unhinged individual who felt, you know, I mean, the thing with Venom, it was the perfect marriage. It was Eddie Brock, the individual who felt a personal hatred for Peter Parker because of some stuff dealing with the Sin Eater and the death of Gene DeWolf and all that arc from the late 80s. And then you had the alien symbiote that gave him his Venom powers, which which Spider-Man rejected when he discovered it was an alien that was going to feed on him. And so it was that perfect marriage of just, you know, mental instability and vengeance and you know, and that's what made Venom so captivating, was that, you know, his goal was just to get Spider-Man. He wasn't trying to take over the world or, you know, get millions of dollars or anything like that. He just wanted to kill Spider-Man because he wronged him, and it was, you know, he viewed himself as an innocent who was wronged by the villain. And you know, whenever you can always kind of flip the hero and villain thing on its ear, it's interesting. But, you know, again, towards the end, it just became, and now Flash Thompson, the bully from Peter Parker's high school, is Venom, which is just weird. And yeah, just don't even know where to go with that.
Okay, we'll set that aside for the moment. Yeah. Let's look at the next issue on your list. This is an anniversary issue. You have the first of a couple that you have. And anniversary issues often don't fare well in comic book form, but in this case, it made your list. I also see it's connected to the dreaded Clone Saga, so there must have been something pretty special about Amazing Spider-Man number 400 to reach number 8 on your list.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's funny. The anniversary issues, actually, I always felt like Spider-Man kind of bucked that trend. I always enjoyed the 100 and 200 and the 300 issues. So 400 kind of, you know, just kind of falls in line. But this is one of my all-time favorites, in large part. This is a situation where both the story is really great, but also kind of the personal experience is, because, you know, when I mentioned Amazing Spider-Man 300 when it had come out, I was, you know, 7 years old. I bought it off the rack, and, you know, I destroyed my copy, and then found out that, you know, years later, that Amazing Spider-Man 300 was worth over $100. That just kind of blew my mind as a kid. So when Amazing Spider-Man 400 was coming out, I just remember being with my friends at school, and there was all this anticipation. And of course, this was also at the height of the comic book speculation boom era of the 90s, where, you know, we had X-Men with interlocking covers and chromium foil embossed Silver Surfers and all that stuff. So, I mean, Marvel was totally trying to cater to this idea that, you know, whatever this, with, you know, this comic could be the next big thing for you, for your bank account, in addition to that. So I mean, I actually, you know, went to my local comic book shop, and I was not going to be denied. A couple of months before this came out, I pre-ordered copies. I actually got a phone call from the store owner the Tuesday night before it officially released. He said, the box came in, do you want to get your copy? I had my you know, 13 years old, I had my mom drive me to the comic book store at like 9 o'clock at night to get this copy. And you know, I opened it up and they got this die cut tombstone, and it's actually a hideous looking cover. It's like, you know, Snow White and you just can't see anything.
I just
on the cover, and I'm thinking about Death of Superman and what a, you know, all the hysteria that caused when it came out. And what they ended up doing was and I always say his last name wrong, and you'll correct me here, J.M. DeMatteis, right?
Yeah, I actually saw Jay.
Oh, okay.
I saw him at a panel this weekend at WonderCon, and I believe that's how his name was pronounced, Mr. J.M. DeMatteis. He was a gentleman in that, and he actually referenced this issue. He mentioned killing off Aunt May, which is the central feature. That's why we have a tombstone on the cover of Amazing Spider-Man number 4, is because this is where Aunt May dies, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Except, of course, they inevitably retconned it as part of the Clone Saga. But, you know, we won't get into that again. Kind of like the last issue. If you know, in a vacuum, if other things didn't happen, this was the perfect farewell for this character, who has been, you know, Peter's mother basically. There's actually very little Spider-Man in this issue. This is a very Peter Parker focused issue, and it does accelerate the much reviled Clone Saga, but it does it in this very human way, where, you know, what's basically happening throughout is while May is kind of going through what's clearly her last days with Peter, he's sitting there and he's trying to remember certain things, and he's like struggling with Mary Jane and saying, you know, why can't I remember this? And it kind of plants the seed, you know, is he the real one? Is he the clone? But but it does it in a very subtle way, and it's not, and you know, in a way that's understandable, that, you know, this is just a very stressful time for Peter. But Peter and May have this very beautiful scene where they're on the Empire, top of the Empire State Building, and, you know, they're just talking, and of course talking about Uncle Ben and all that, and May says to him, well, you know, I know you're Spider-Man, and, you know, this is like, you know, been the big mystery, you know, in the previous 399 issues of this series, you know, this May, will May ever find out, you know, Peter was always convinced it would kill her. And then, of course, she says that, and then she goes, Peter, I need to go home, it's time to go, but what she means by go is, you know, the big go. And, you know, they sit there and they reminisce a little bit, and, you know, she actually quotes, Peter Pan, which is, you know, a very meaningful childhood story to me. You know, second to the right and straight on till morning, and then passes. And it's this very beautiful scene. And I actually recently, reviewed this issue for, another blog that I write for over at, CBR, it's Comics Should Be Good. I do this Gimmick or Good column where I look at, you know, gimmick covers and basically, you know, analyze, are these comics actually good, or are they just, you know, gimmick fluff put out by, you know, the publishers? And a lot of people in those comments were talking like, yeah, you know, I definitely cried when I read this issue. And I'm like, yeah, me too. I mean, it's just such a fitting emotional ending. And, you know, with the personal buildup of getting this issue and thinking this was going to be something, you know, I was going to pay my college tuition. Of course it didn't, but at least it delivered a really great emotional story.
Well, that's the, and it's another touchstone that Spider-Man does well, is that because he's such a human skilled character, and because he has this supporting cast of characters that's maybe unrivaled in comics, the emotional relationships, the emotional reality of this character that underlies all this fantastic action is as strong or stronger as anything else in comics. So when a character like Aunt May dies, that, you know, it's sensationalized, and it's, you know, it's part of a big sales push and an anniversary issue and all the rest of those things, but it still resonates. It's still genuine. And having the way you just describe it, with the scene where she's revealed, well, of course, Peter, I've always known that you've been Spider-Man, just kind of, it makes the story even more bittersweet. It makes me wonder what, you know, what years Peter lost by carrying this secret, all the additional stress he brought on himself because he wanted to spare it to his aunt, might, you know, how might their relationship have been better or deepened if they'd been able to share this knowledge, this secret with each other. It's you know, when a fictional character dies, no matter how moving, ultimately it's a fictional character. But when you think of the loss and how it applies to your own life, then it becomes something more. It sounds like this story transcended a little bit the limitations of a comic book issue and spoke to you on a personal level.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is. I mean, it just speaks to that general loss. And like you said, I mean, when you look at other comic book characters, I mean, that kind of maternal relationship, you don't always get that from superhero comics. I mean, it's just, you know, you don't hear much about Tony Stark's mom or Mr. Fantastic's mom or anything. I mean, it's just kind of to have that connection. And it, like you said, it just drives home once again why this character is so different from others. I mean, you know, there's a reason why his popularity is kind of unique, and that his fans are so passionate that they would go, I think, a little over the edge when the, you know, big plot reveal was came out for Amazing Spider-Man 700. But all the same, it does attract, I think, a very emotional fan base.
And it speaks to how genuine the character is, because, you know, plenty of characters have death in their background. You know, my favorite comic book character is Captain America, and he's sniveling about Bucky in every other panel, practically, in the 60s and the 70s. Yeah. It's, oh, God, Bucky, you know, and it becomes a joke. But in Spider-Man run, Spidey, you know, Peter was always very concerned about poor old Aunt May, who looks like she could be taken out by a stiff wind. But, you know, for whatever reason, that character never became that kind of parody. It was a very genuine character. I think that relationship between her and Peter was critical to what made the book special. And I'm glad you've acknowledged it here with Amazing Spider-Man number 400. No matter what has happened since then with their relationship, it came to a fitting conclusion of that issue, it sounds like.
Yeah. I could explain to you how they brought her back, but, you know, I don't want to make your head spin too much. But all I can say, it also involves the resurrection of Norman Osborn. And, you know, when you start getting into that, you know, a character that had been dead for over 200-something issues, you know there's trouble.
Yeah, it's characters rarely are brought back from the dead for the better. In Captain America's case, Ed Brubaker did a great job bringing Bucky back with Winter Soldier, but it really is the exception that proves the rule. What is dead should stay dead in comics, I think, although that's rarely the case. So, right. The next issue is it's Amazing Spider-Man number 32, but not the number 32 we're thinking of. It's volume 2, number 32, right?
Correct. Yeah, no, I mean, the other 32 would be the middle section of the Master Planner arc, but this is something different, and this, I'm assuming, is probably another one of the really controversial choices, just because it's very contemporary. It's 2001. It's J. Michael Straczynski, who, you know, is kind of, you know, he's of course the writer of, you know, Babylon 5 and countless other comic books, and he you know, people either love him or hate him. He definitely kind of has attracted that, but, you know, in the very beginning, you know, JMS, he much like Roger Stern 15 years prior, kind of resurrected the title. I mean, the Spider-Man was kind of left for dead in the wake of the Clone Saga and all the other following events. And they initially stopped sequencing it at issue 441, which I never understood where, you know, the arbitrary cutoff for that. Went to a volume 2, which, you know, basically lasted for about 50 issues until they resumed the regular numbering. JMS jumped on at volume 2, number 30, and started with this arc that was a little mystical in tone, and people either loved it or hated it. And I loved it, and I especially loved 32, because 32 is, you know, has this sequence that not only changed how I thought about Spider-Man, it kind of really defined how I think about superhero comics in general, because, you know, the whole mystical element that JMS brings into this is this kind of this chicken or egg question of, you know, yes, you were bitten by a radioactive spider and that's where you got your powers. But is that really how this all happened? Or did you maybe have these powers from birth and the spider bite kind of gave you awareness and tapped into, you know, this natural animalistic nature you had? And you know, it kind of sounds like Huey, but then, you know, there's this character, Ezekiel, who is explaining this to Peter. He brings up the example, like, have you ever noticed that most of your adversaries are based out of animals? It's because, you know, we're all these totems, they call them, and you're the spider totem, and there's the vulture totem and the rhino totem, and of course your greatest nemesis of all is just like you. He's got eight appendages and very scientifically smart, and, you know, of course he's talking about Doc Ock, and this would set the stage for you know, events later down with the whole superior transition. And you know, even at that point, Peter's kind of like, oh yeah, that is a good point. Maybe there is something to this. And you know, he kind of applies it to other heroes and villains, kind of the yin and yang relationship between, you know, the hero and his arch nemesis, you know, Captain America with, you know, with the Red Skull, and the X-Men with Magneto, and you know, and Thor and Loki, you know, these you know, gods fight gods, and patriots fight, you know, traitors or other kinds of nationalists, and it just, you know, I guess it's an obvious point, but when you kind of see it spelled out for you, it kind of brought a new awareness for me for how, not only just how I consume comic books, but how I read them and become a little analytical about them. It kind of gave it a little bit of a higher intellectual edge to it. And you know, I'm not ashamed by my education and stuff like that. So I kind of liked that, you know, there are Spider-Man comic books out there that you can be a little, you know, a little hoity-toity and smart about. It's not just, you know, whatever Alan Moore wrote, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Alan Moore, because I'm not familiar with this issue, but it sounds very clever, and it does sound like an Alan Moore-style kind of, you know, new perspective or reinvention of the character, an internal reinvention that causes you to look at everything that's gone in the past from a different angle. But whereas Alan Moore, you know, slashed and burned everything he wrote, by the time he left a book, there wasn't nothing but ashes, you know, left for the team that followed him. I gather this sounds like it was a little bit more positive of a reinvention for Spider-Man.
Yeah, although they did end up abandoning a lot of the groundwork that JMS laid out when Dan Slott came aboard. Because, I mean, JMS basically lasted until the whole Brand New Day, One More Day transition, which is the other kind of dark stain on the character. The fact that they dissolved his marriage with Mary Jane, with this deal with Mephisto and all this other silliness. Just to kind of, I guess, almost reboot the series in a sense and bring on a new kind of cavalry of writers. But I was actually kind of happy recently in reading The Scarlet Spider, which is one of the spin-off series that's currently coming out that stars actually the clone of Spider-Man, which you would think I would not want nothing to do with. But, you know, on a whim, I gave it a try and I've actually really enjoyed it. But they recently resurrected a lot of this philosophy and the totem powers and this thing called the other, which is, you know, like you're the man or the other, which is the spider. It was nice to see it in that context. And I actually think in terms of with the clone, it kind of makes sense to play up his animal side more than his human side, because he's not necessarily true human anyway. But it was nice to see Marvel actually acknowledge it again for the first time in about 8 years.
Now this, we'll go off the script a little bit here, but this, this other character, this spider aspect of Spider-Man, that's an issue, or that's an element I also recall being addressed in the Kraven's Last Hunt series, which I know is not included in your top 10. So that's where we're going off the script. But was that, did Kraven's Last Hunt, did that come before the Straczynski run on Spider-Man, or was that after?
Yeah, Craven's Last Hunt was like the mid to late 80s, I think like 86, 87, around then. So and that was DeMatteis. And you know, again, because DeMatteis was always very kind of plugged into the human, to human emotion and those elements that, but I think Straczynski almost meant it a little, he meant it more literally, in terms of the animal side. I mean, there is one run that came maybe 30 or so issues after this volume 232, and this is where I think JMS started to kind of lose me. I mean, Peter actually died, and molted his skin and came back because this was like a untapped spider power he didn't realize he had. And that's where it's like, okay, now you're kind of, now you're pushing it. Although he did get like very cool night vision, which was like, again, something they kind of abandoned. But, my understanding, I have not read Craven's Last Hunt in a while. But I mean, I think it was more, wasn't as literal as that, I don't think.
No, it was more, there was just this shadow of this totemic sort of spider aspect that was sort of cast in opposition to Craven's hunter aspect. And then, of course, Craven tries to understand and assume that spider aspect by physically consuming spiders and taking on his enemy's skin. And it just seemed to touch against a vaguely similar neighborhood, but it doesn't sound exactly like the direction that Straczynski went.
Yeah, he went a little crazy with it, but yeah, absolutely. I do remember the Craven taking on the skin and trying to, you know, get inside the enemy. I mean, that's a really cool arc, but yeah, I mean, you know, spoiler alert, that doesn't make the list just because that also is a very sprawling arc in terms of crossing different spider titles and stuff like that, and it was hard to kind of pinpoint one individual issue as like being influential. I mean, you know, it's very famous stuff that happens, but you know, all the same, I just didn't feel like it fit into the flow of this list at all.
Yeah, you're looking at individual issues more than arcs. It wasn't there an issue of Spider-Man early on where he grew additional arms? Wasn't that some shocking revelation? Spider-Man grew two additional arms at some point.
Yeah, well, that was 100. That was the first of the centennial extravaganzas, and it's actually the last Stan Lee issue, although I think Conway wrote the bulk of it. But with that one, he was actually trying, you know, it was one of the infamous "I'm tired of being Spider-Man" issues. I'm going to take this serum from the Lizard, or from Kirk Connors, which I don't know why you would take any serum from Kirk Connors, because, you know, he took serum and became a Lizard, trying to regrow his arm. And of course, Spider-Man gets two extra arms and it becomes the Human Spider. But again, that's more of a kind of just a sci-fi fantasy thing. It really wasn't tapping into, you know, are you spider or are you man? I mean, it was just, oh, how is he going to get out of this? And, you know, and of course they play up like, you know, Gwen Stacy wants to come over for a date. And, you know, Peter's like, oh, she can't see me like this. I have six arms. It's like, no, duh.
That's a big problem. That and adjusting your costume, I expect, would be right at the top of the list.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, so much for that diversion. Let's get back on your list here. The next issue up, we're up to number 6 on your top 10 here, I think, and it's a Dan Slott issue. So this is a more recent entry in Spider-Man's history.
Yes. Yeah, this is the most contemporary issue on my list. We do go back basically to mostly the Silver and Bronze Age from here on out, but I did have to give Dan Slott his due. Dan Slott certainly has some enemies in the Spider-Man fan universe. I don't think I'm one of them, although I met him recently and I introduced myself and he said, oh, you don't always like what I do. And I'm like, I'm not as bad as I'm not as mean as these other people. I'm not like sending him death threats or making YouTube videos that, like, you know, to try and troll him or anything like that. But so Dan, if you're listening, I do enjoy your work generally. I just, you know, there's just been certain things he's done that I'm not wild about. But to me, that one of the pinnacle dance plot arcs was Spider Island, and I think one of the big reasons why I had such fondness for the arc is for this specific issue. This is kind of the issue that I feel really connects to me with the contemporary fan base. This came out early on while I was blogging. This was kind of the first major spider event that I blogged about. You know, the general concept for Spider Island was, you know, the Jackal who was, you know, another character who was responsible for clones and whatnot. And thus you would think I would automatically hate, but in this case, actually it worked out. The Jackal creates a virus that got transmitted via bedbugs. Of course, it's New York City. How else would things get transmitted? And it gives everybody Spider-Man powers until they eventually actually become spiders. So again, we're turning into spiders, but not JMS spiders. And you know, it's one of those, you know, all hands on deck kind of situations. The Avengers are there. The Fantastic Four are there. Captain America gets turned into this big grotesque spider, and they use the Flash Thompson Venom to save him, which is a whole other thing. But that's in his series. It's this big sprawling arc that has mini series and one shots and goes into other issues. But then Amazing Spider-Man 672 just ties everything up so neatly and so expertly. Like I'm floored by how Slott brings it all together. And not only does he bring it together, but he gives Peter and, you know, Peter as Spider-Man and Peter as Peter, just these amazing character moments that just, you know, again, these are the reasons why you love the character. You know, there's this one scene where he has on this mind control helmet that he has abducted from Doc Ock, which, you know, hint, hint, is part of what eventually leads to the mind switch. So not only is Slott tying together Spider Island, but he's actually laying seeds for future arcs in this. But he uses this mind control helmet to, you know, basically work all these machines to deliver the antidote for all the people of New York. So while the Avengers are having this chaotic, you know, explosive, you know, Michael Bay battle on the streets below, Peter is up above, you know, on top of the Chrysler Building, Empire State Building, giving all these people, you know, basically saving the city, saving the people, you know, like not dealing with the villains, but saving everyone else. And the person who's up there with him is Mary Jane. And this is, you know, post wedding dissolving. And, you know, it's just nice to see the two of them have this moment again. And you know, it's almost kind of this mea culpa from Marvel. Like, yeah, we know we probably shouldn't have broken these two up, but, you know, we'll at least give you this and show like her kind of supporting him and having his back. And at one point she even says, I love you, but it's in such a platonic way that it's not even planting the seeds of romance. You just know that it's just as a friend. And it just makes you proud that, you know, Peter is basically, you know, Peter is saving the city and he's doing it himself. And he even says at the very, very end, he's like, I did this. If it wasn't for me, the city would be filled with human spiders. And I got the resources together. I got the Avengers to do what they needed to do. And I did what I needed to do. And, you know, it's just those kind of moments where, you know, you just love being a Spider-Man fan. And I kind of initially expressed that exuberance for it on the blog when it first came out. And I think that kind of connected me with a lot of fans and people who've been kind of reading ever since, because I think a lot of hardcore Spider-Man fans felt the same thing when they read it.
Well, it's, you know, it's worth giving credit where it's due, because we've taken Marvel to task earlier this evening talking about, you know, too many symbiotes, or Aunt May's dead, no, she's not, or Clone Sagas. But in this case, it sounds like editorial stability and some long-range planning on behalf of Marvel and Dan Slott led not only just to a satisfying conclusion for the what could have been a sprawling Spider-Island story, but as you note, also laid the seeds for Amazing Spider-Man number 700. That's, you know, in comic books where creative teams can shuffle on a monthly basis, it seems like, it's exceptional that someone can stick with a book that long and also have that long range of vision for where he wants to guide the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were actually seeds planted for 700 and issue 600. And I think that's another reason why I can't get too upset by some of the recent events, because you really have to respect that kind of long range planning. You just, like you said, you just don't see that right now in comics. I mean, it's, you know, you could try and put that long range planning in, and then a new creative team comes on and they'll undo it. And Marvel has put its stock in Slott, in Dan Slott. You know, when they launched their Marvel Now initiative a few months ago, you know, they switched up a lot of the creative teams. You had Brian Michael Bendis writing X-Men when all he's ever written was Avengers. You know, well, over the last 10 years or so, you know, they threw Jonathan Hickman from Fantastic Four to Avengers. They, you know, they've decided to do some little-known titles about Hawkeye that's become this phenomena with Matt Fraction. But with Spider-Man, they kept Dan Slott on, and they were very purposeful for it, because they basically said, we believe in the story, in the arc that Dan is weaving right now, and we don't want to disrupt it. We don't want, you know, we don't want to have that situation where someone else comes on and says, I didn't like this. I'm gonna undo this. I'm gonna change that. So you have to give respect to both Dan and to Marvel for for sticking to the game plan, so to speak.
Well, there's something to be said for stability, and it is a rare thing today. It was maybe not as rare a thing, well, certainly in Spider-Man's history in his early days, Silver Age of Spider-Man. The how long was Stanley in the book? First 100 issues or so, or am I?
Yeah.
So I mean,
yeah, I mean, issue, I think in the late 90s issues, he kind of started to start feeding some of them to other writers. But I mean, granted, you know, there are people who say that Ditko basically wrote the bulk of the first 38 issues.
Yeah, but I think that's a fair assessment.
But, you know, that, yeah, it depends on who you're sourcing from.
Well, I think Stan Lee was always eager to delegate, and when he was working with a creator like Ditko or Jack Kirby that were comfortable writing and plotting on their own, he was happy to have the other guy take the wheel. But I also think that, Stan Lee made an indelible contribution to that character, guiding it through his early years. And the next issue on your list here is a Stan Lee issue. It's one I actually recognize, or at least I recognize the talent. It's issue number 90 of Amazing Spider-Man, scripted by Stan Lee with pencils by Gil Kane. And I see inks by John Romita Sr. So tell me about Spider-Man number 90 and why it makes number 5 on your list, Mark.
Yes, this is the first of the death of stories from the, I guess, you know, the end of the Silver Age, early Bronze Age, Spidey era. And, you know, what has always made this issue stand out to me is, actually, it's kind of this odd thing with me where, you know, here I am, I'm a kid who started reading comics when Peter got married to Mary Jane, and yet I've always had this odd affinity towards the Stacys, Captain Stacy and Gwen Stacy. Gwen Stacy, Peter's first love, first true love. If you know, some people think she was the ultimate love, but obviously, the Green Goblin intervened with that, and Spider-Man's webbing. But with I've always had this affinity towards them because, again, it kind of plays into the loss and death aspects of Spider-Man, these very tragic circumstances that have just colored his life. And, you know, in the case of Captain Stacy, we have another father figure who, you know, it was basically kind of filling in for Peter's Uncle Ben, because he was this, you know, older, you know, respected, former police captain. That's why he's Captain Stacy. And, you know, in very heroic circumstances, Captain Stacy is killed trying to push a little boy out of the way of falling a brick face while Peter and while Spider-Man and Doc Ock are fighting on a rooftop. And of course, you know, Spider-Man, as always, gets blamed for the death of Captain Stacy, even by his girlfriend Gwen Stacy. Well, she didn't know he was Spider-Man, and it's this overall sadness, and you know, we have another one of these reveals where as Captain Stacy is breathing his last breath, you know, Spider-Man is holding him and telling him to hold on, and Captain Stacy says, "Take care of her, Peter," and it just has chills. This idea that Captain Stacy knew all this time that Peter was Spider-Man, and it, you know, this wasn't just kind of a contrived plot twist. I mean, there was the part of the reason why Captain Stacy was always so friendly with Peter was he was like, "Oh, you always take great pictures of this Spider-Man. How do you get so close? How are you so close to him? Do you have a relationship with him? What do you know about him? I don't think he's the menace that other people say he is. What can you tell me about him? I want to clear his name." And, you know, and Peter even comments many times throughout the series, like, "Oh, he's getting a little too close for comfort here." So the fact that this comes out in his death, and it's just so tragic and just completely floors you. And, like I said, it's part of the reason why I just have this affinity towards these characters, because they're such well-drawn supporting characters, and you really didn't have, when I started reading many of these like older fatherly figures that were as well-rounded as Cat Stacy was, and you know, it kind of made me, you know, nostalgic, like, you know, what would I have felt like if I had read this, you know, as it came out in the 60s, it probably would have just really upended me, instead of just kind of looking back at it almost historically, you know, instead you're actually living in the moment, kind of like what I did with Aunt May's death for 400.
Yeah, I think it echoes
that. So for that reason, it just really stood out to me as this kind of Stanley's masterwork in many ways.
I think the storytelling, when you put it in those terms, I think the story in Amazing Spider-Man number 400 echoes a lot of these same beats, in that we have this character that to a young person, to a youthful reader, may appear to be kind of an old fool. You know, he can't notice what's right under his nose. It's obvious to me, it's obvious to the reader, but they're unable to put the pieces together and figure out that that Peter is Spider-Man. But at the end, we find out that he's not foolish at all, that instead he's indulgent and he's loving and he's supportive, and he respected our hero enough that he wasn't going to put him on the spot by making him reveal something that he wasn't ready to reveal. In this, it sounds like he and Aunt May are very similar, and it's interesting because it reveals, you know, a facet or a characteristic of superior storytelling, is it can say different things to you at different times during your life. I would expect, you know, we're bringing an adult perspective, looking back on Amazing Spider-Man number 90, encountering that for the first time as a 10 or 12 year old, and then reading it again as a 30 year old. I think you get very different experiences from that same story.
Yeah, no, without question. And you know, the same could be said for probably the next two issues on my list. I mean, this whole, you know, how has time changed the events?
Yeah, well, there are big events coming up here. Let's plow right on ahead with Amazing Spider, with a fourth entry on your list, which is a Steve Ditko issue. At last, we get to Steve Ditko. If I were going to do a top 10 list of Amazing Spider-Man, all my issues would probably come from Amazing Spider-Man number 1 through 39, or whatever it was when the Steve Ditko era, and I'd include the first annual in there. So I'm glad to see that Ditko and Lee issue makes the list. It's Amazing Spider-Man number 33. So why this one among the many Ditko and Lee issues? What makes this one stand out?
Yeah. That's a great question, because then when I initially wrote this post, I kind of talked about I have a very conflicting relationship with Steve Ditko. I don't know him, so I shouldn't make it sound like, you know, we call each other up and fight all the time. But you know,
you could claim it. Who could disprove it?
What was that?
I said you could claim that. No one would be able to disprove it, given that Mr. Ditko is such a recluse. You should say he's going to be the guy that sends you Amazing Spider-Man number 1. You know that, right?
There you go. Yeah, well, you know, I I gotta watch you, I badmouth. No, it's a very complicated thing with Ditko, because, you know, on one hand, I completely recognize the fact that he is, you know, responsible for, you know, I mean, not even just the foundation of Spider-Man, but I mean, you know, like you said, those first 38 issues, they are great. They're fantastic. I mean, like, yeah. all this great villains emerge from that. You have the Sinister Six in that run. You have, you know, just the common elements of, like, Parker Luck and his family relationships. You know, I recently on the blog, to kind of celebrate the 50th anniversary of its release, I kind of did a review of ASM number one, and it's just such a different tone from any other superhero comic book. And that's a lot of that's Ditko. Yes. I mean, it's Stan too, you know, Stan has a sensibility to it and kind of adds a little bit of fun and flair, but, you know, Ditko is definitely, you know, the more I've read about him, you know, kind of the serious partner and you know, kind of, yeah. And apparently he was a big, devout follower of Ayn Rand, and like, he tried to work those elements into early Spider-Man. And, you know, so while I respect and I'm obviously I'm in awe of what he helped create, at the same time, I just sometimes feel that Peter is a little too angry and angsty in during the Ditko run. And I just wish I kind of liked when he got a little softer. I liked that he became a, you know, he was chasing girls towards, you know, in the Romita and Stanley era, you know, with Gwen and Mary Jane and, you know, wearing, you know, 60s dresses and go-go boots and everything. I kind of liked the life that you know, that era introduced. So in many ways, it's hard for me to, like, have a personal fondness for a lot of the Ditko issues, because it's more of a respect than an actual, you know, love affair for. It's not much fun for me.
I think, you know, I think Ditko's contribution, you can kind of determine what his contribution was by, if you try to pull Stanley out of the book and look at the negative space, what remains, it's assumed that's all Ditko. And Steve Ditko doesn't have a huge body of work at Marvel aside from Spider-Man and Doctor Strange, which is another classic strip. So it's difficult to get a handle on what he was really interested in at that time. But what Stan was writing about was, he was either writing just sort of, you know, revisionist Fantastic Four style, you know, science fiction superhero stories, or he was writing about misunderstood monsters, I think, were the things that he really kind of dwelled on. With Spider-Man, I think, you know, the alienation of the character and the very strong sense of responsibility for his own actions that's at the core of the character, I think we can really attribute that to Ditko. I think that speaks to his core values. And yeah, the character is angsty and is an outsider. But what I found when I reread these books about a year and a half ago, is that Peter isn't, as much a nerd as I thought he was. You know, he has relationships with girls. He's got Betty Brant. He has Flash Thompson's girl is always, you know, batting her eyes at him. And
right.
You know, it's not that Peter's a total, it's not that he's a failure with women. It's just that he's, you know, he feels himself an outsider, and he's uncomfortable, I think, in his own skin. He's angsty, as you say. And yeah, and those things were overturned when John Romita came along and, you know, was able to draw these beautiful women with his background in romance comics. And the whole series kind of gets slicked up and more glamorous. But I think because at his heart, you know, Peter's a worthy guy who's hiding his worth from the world for a lot of reasons, that transition didn't feel as abrupt or as artificial as it might have been if those aspects weren't in the character.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. But, you know, and the thing is, the reason why I eventually settled on issue 33 here is because, I mean, this is the pinnacle of the Ditko run. If this be my destiny three-parter that starts in issue 31, and issue 33, of course, has the very famous scene where Spider-Man is trapped underneath tons of steel and running and water, you know, during his fight with Doc Ock, and he's trying to get this serum to save his Aunt May, who is in the hospital because of Peter. He gives her a blood transfusion, and it's his radioactive blood that he gives her. So that, you know, if he's got this responsibility to save his to save this mother character, to not fail her like he failed as Uncle Ben. And, you know, we as he's laying trapped beneath, you know, the steel and rubble, he's having these visions of how he failed as Uncle Ben. And, you know, and like you said, this idea of responsibility, this really big idea of responsibility. And I mean, but to me, this kind of transcended because it's like kind of brings it all together, these three issues, and of course this is one specific one. And you know, I even write as such in the post that, like, I can't call myself a Spider-Man fan if this issue doesn't show up in my list somewhere. It's just like you have to understand that this is everything what that character was about in his first, in, you know, in the beginning years. And you know, just to you know, just because sometimes the tone of the series wasn't bright and cheery as I wanted it to be, or as it became later, doesn't mean that that you can't, that this isn't still just a great work of art, you know, both visually and text wise, and that's why this ends up cracking the top four.
You talk about Spidey getting off the mat here. It's a theme that you touched on in its Juggernaut fight, that the, you know, the character's overcoming impossible odds. You refer to it as a fist pump moment of storytelling. It seems to be something you look for in Spider-Man a lot.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's that perseverance, it's that overcoming odds, it's finding the inspiration from him. You know, Spider-Man is never really portrayed as the strongest dog in the fight, or you know, he's smart but not the smartest in the Marvel universe. I mean, it's always, you know, on the scale of 1 to 10, you know, he's always, you know, when you look at his attributes, he's always clocking in at like a 6 or 7. He's never a 10 in anything. You know, he's not as strong as the Hulk or the Thing, and you know, he's not you know, basically discovering alternative parallel universes like Mr. Fantastic is, or, you know, he can't, you know, not as tapped into the mystic side like Doctor Strange or anything. So when, you know, despite the fact that he's not the best in anything, when he does overcome these situations that maybe a more powerful or intelligent superhero may not be able to get himself out of, those are the moments I always gravitate towards.
And I think they're, you know, especially acute in this Ditko era, where the character was so, you know, so neurotic and so so close to breakdown seemingly all the time, so beset by internal demons. I don't know the number off the top of my head. Of course, you will know instantly, Mark, but my favorite Ditko Lee story is from very similar, or from, I think it's from this era. It's a single issue story where Mysterio concocts to drive Spider-Man out of his mind and builds a fun house where he's nailed all the furniture to the ceiling, and he's using projectors to make him think that his greatest foes have come back against him. And it's a gimmicky story, but what sticks with me about that story is it doesn't take much to push Peter practically over the edge. A few funhouse effects, and he's thinking, I got to give up the Spider-Man thing. I'm losing my mind. What if I'm a threat to myself? What if I hurt Aunt May? I mean, this kid is just really on the edge.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So that's issue 24 that you're thinking of. That's a great issue. A few issues before that, there's issue 17. It's the second Green Goblin and Spider-Man. I mean, he finds out this is actually the issue. That's the issue where he gets made of blood that ends up causing the issues down the road. You know, he's leaving a fight, and like, you got the Human Torch shoes there too. And, you know, in the very beginning, Spidey and Torch do not get along because they're both young hotheads, pun not intended there, I guess. And you know, Torch is kind of like, hey dude, where are you going? And Spidey's like, I got more important stuff to do. Like, I can't let May down again. And it's kind of like this stunning thing. You know, I mean, I know earlier I talked about him not backing down from a fight. So when he does, it's always kind of unnerving. And that's certainly one of those cases. It's this idea that, that Ditko really taps into, like you said, this angst and responsibility and you know, just always being on the edge and just being neurotic about it.
And that's, you remind me now that Spider-Man Torch relationship really is very interesting in the Silver Age, maybe worthy of a show or a column all by itself, because it exemplifies how those early Marvel comics were greater than the sum of the parts, the way they crossed over and discovered new dimensions by bringing their characters together. And And Johnny Storm, the Torch, really is kind of, you know, Spider-Man turned inside out. He has a public identity. He's a golden boy. Everything he does works out. You know, he's a celebrity. He gets his pick of the girls. You know, his future is assured. He doesn't have to worry about making the rent. You can see why Spider-Man might resent a guy like that. It's almost like, you know, Flash Thompson suddenly got superpowers. Maybe he'd be Johnny Storm.
Oh, that's a great analogy. And I always loved how in the very first issue of Amazing Spider-Man, you know, he tries to join the Fantastic Four because he wants to make some money, Spider-Man. And it's just kind of, you know, like Torch basically saying, you know, what are you, stupid? We're not a paying organization.
it's a classic moment that sets
him up from there.
And it, you know, that was Stan Lee deep in his period of, okay, what always happens in a superhero story? Let's turn it inside out. So I'll have a character that's going to use his powers to try to get money, and then he can't. Or, you know, he returns to the story two or three times. Spidey eventually is paid, but he can't cash the check without giving up his identity. So, I mean, there's a certain gimmickry there, but there's also, you know, it speaks to the core of these characters and how very strong they were, that you could tell these stories time and again, and they're still, you know, they're still entertaining all these years later.
No, yeah, I mean, definitely. But you're right about the whole Torch dynamic. I mean, it's a lot of fun to watch. And you just saying the Flash Thompson comparison really has like my wheels turning right now. All these years of reading, I never thought about it that way, and I just really appreciate that comparison.
Aha! Uh-huh. Well, there's a column for you. I'll expect it at Longbox Greater. You know, the thing about Spidey one of the things I like about him is that the character, you know, he really grits his teeth. He the audience wants to see him cut loose, but Spidey remains, you know, he recognizes that with great power comes great responsibility. And I recall, again, it's a story from the Lee Ditko era, where, of course, you know, Flash Thompson is always writing Spider-Man, or always writing Peter. And then the irony is that Flash is Spidey's biggest fan. He's the, you know, the captain of the fan club. He's always writing Spider-Man's defense. But there was also an issue where Spidey, or where Peter and Flash are finally going to have their big fist fight. You know, it's high noon at the flagpole, and it's on. And Peter realizes that he could kill Flash easily, and has to pull himself back from doing that, even though it would be so satisfying to just, you know, wipe the floor with this kid that's tormented him, even at this young age. And, you know, he must be supposed to be 16, 17 years old or something in this particular issue. He has the wisdom and the strength of character to separate his feelings from Flash from what he knows is the right thing.
Oh yeah, I mean, he was ready that, you know, he could have just been arrogant and ended him, and you know, he knows better.
Yeah. What kid wouldn't want to put paid to a bully? All right. Well, you know, maybe we'll have another talk about Ditko and Lee. I'm glad that they warned at least one position in your top 10. I know you have a deep respect for their work, and it's tough to pick. You know, we're talking about 50 years worth of comics here. You could easily do a top 100 and be angry that someone's issue was excluded. But we're up to the podium now. If this is the Olympics, we've reached the bronze medal. Your number three story of Amazing Spider-Man. And this is issue number 122, which is interesting because issue 121, of course, is the big one, right? The critical moment in the history of Spider-Man. But you select issue number 122 as your favorite on the list. So tell us about those two issues and why 122 gets the
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, 121 is the death of Gwen Stacy, which, depending on, you know, how you follow comic book history, is you know, basically considered the end of the Silver Age, because, you know, up until that point, you never had a, you know, the girl of the hero never died, especially because of the hero, you know, his failure to save her. And, you know, I mean, it obviously marked a transitional period for a lot of comic books where things started to get a grittier, darker edge, in terms of, you know, drugs and death and all these things. Although, you know, Marvel had been kind of doing that in Spider-Man, leading up to that. But yes, I picked 122, which is the follow-up, and that's most notable for the death or the then death of the Green Goblin / Norman Osborn, because I actually feel that it's just a better story than 121. 121 is while it's the more famous issue in terms of just you know, significance in the medium because of its events, you know, the story kind of meanders for the first half or so, and then it kind of just accelerates very quickly towards the end where the goblin kidnaps her, and then, you know, the fight, and then out of nowhere, Gwen Stacy's dead. And like, I just felt like the build wasn't appropriate. I kind of made a joke if, you know, Brian Michael Bendis was telling the story today, which, you know, Brian Michael Bendis is notorious for taking his sweet time in developing stories. You know, there would be one issue where, you know, Green, you know, Gwen was kidnapped, and there'd be one issue of the goblin flying to the bridge, and then there'd be another issue of them on the bridge. I mean, you know, like, it didn't have to be to that extreme, but like, I felt like there could have been more of a build. But they obviously, you know, I mean, that 121 advertises someone's going to die. They obviously wanted to deliver on that promise, and not leave, any ends untied in that regard. But, you know, 122 is the better story for me because, you know, now you're finally, as a reader, faced with a situation of, you know, Spider-Man has always, stops short of ever physically, you know, killing or really going to town on his opponents. I mean, you know, like, he's, again, that power and responsibility thing. He's not a vigilante. He's a hero. And, you know, there's a case where, like, I mean, I just, you know, you read the events from the prior issue, then you see his showdown with the goblin, and you kind of pull him for Spidey to just end him, you know, like this lunatic who, you know, has this crazy son that he's damaging because of his emotional abuse, and, you know, now he's going after your family, and he's the only one who knows your identity, and, you know, like, if you just want to get it over with, do it, you know, like, I mean, that was my impression. It's like, you know, like, if you, this is the time, if there's ever a moment to cross the line, this is that moment. And Spider-Man almost does, and then he doesn't. And again, it just really speaks volumes about his character. And then, of course, you know, the goblin ends up doing the deed himself by summoning his glider. But Peter, you know, Spider-Man jumps out of the way and impales him. But, you know, again, he didn't do it. So you know, he still stayed above the fray, and you know, you're kind of like getting worked up into a lather as his issue's going along as a reader, and then, you know, as Spider-Man steps back off, you know, from the ledge, you do too, and I just loved how the pacing of the story went. And then the other moment with this issue that I always really loved was they finally gave Mary Jane some character. There's this great sequence, very last page, where, you know, she comes by to see Peter, and she's like, "Oh, I'm so broken up about Gwen." And he's kind of, you know, at this point, Mary Jane's just this party girl and, you know, like, little floozy of type. And Peter's like, "No, what do you care? Don't you have a party to go to?" And, you know, she goes to leave because she's offended, and then she just stops, closes the door, and you just know from that point on, like, their relationship is going to have a completely different dynamic, and it kind of plants the seeds for bigger things to come from them.
That is a lot of story that happens in, what, you know, 20, 24, 28 pages or something, isn't it? You mentioned Brian Michael Bendis, you know, if he'd written the preceding issue, it would take 6 years too long. And I love Bendis. I think he's quite a talent, but he really does go on. If Bendis had written the story, Gwen probably wouldn't have died. She would have been cushioned by her fall into a pile of excess word balloons, maybe at the bottom of the bridge, left over from Bendis's style. But it's, I mean, those Silver Age stories, they were told at a breakneck pace, but that doesn't mean that they lacked for substance or emotion or permanence. In many ways, you know, they're more effective than a story told in a more relaxed kind of, you know, writing for the trade point of view.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, you're right. It's, you know, as I'm going through, as I'm reciting plot lines and stuff, it is dense, but it reads quickly. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's, you know, it's not, I was just recently reading, a copy of, X-Men #1, the reboot of it, for this Gimmick or Good thing I was mentioning earlier. And, you know, one of the first things I brought up, you know, it's a 48 pager, so it's like a double sized issue, and it's just, you know, so much exposition and so much setup that, like, it's just like you labor trying to read it. And this, like, it just goes, it clicks, and, you know, you're one scene and your other, you know, it's Spidey confronting Robbie Robertson to get the whereabouts on Norman Osborn. And then he's confronting Norman, and then they fight, and then he almost kills him, and then he stops himself, and then Norman kills himself, and then he's back home, and then it's Mary Jane, and it's just, and in the middle of all this, he's having, you know, reminiscing about Gwen Stacy and her death, and it's just so much going on, but it's just flying, and you know, it's tight, very tightly wound and very crisp, and the, you know, Gil Kane's art is great throughout. I mean, you know, he definitely picks up right where Romita left off in terms of Happy Drew people, you know, younger people especially. It's hard to find a comic book like that in today's marketplace. It's, you know, like you said, they're writing for the trade more than anything else now.
Yeah, well, just like, you know, newer isn't always better, you know, older isn't always worse either. You know, there's a reason that these stories have worked their way into the weave of our popular culture. I already am dreading the moment when poor Gwen Stacy gets her neck snapped in the next Spider-Man movie. I assume it can't help but happen, right?
If they change that, well, I think they've even have had interviews where, you know, Emma Stone has acknowledged that she knows she's probably going to die at some point during this, you know, this next movie or the third movie or whatever. But yeah, it's just part of the mythos, you know. You can't change history. even if you're desperate to. I mean, I guess the Raimi's movies, they changed it, but that was just an odd, I mean, I don't even know why they brought Gwen Stacy into it when they did. It was kind of an odd thing.
Poor Emma Stone's gonna die and gonna break a whole new generation of hearts next year, I think.
I know, right?
Absolutely.
Do we want to move forward?
Yeah.
This is the Brian Michael Bendis of list, I think.
That's right. let's move forward. We got two more issues to go here. One of which the fans can probably guess, and the other which I don't think they're going to guess. Your number one issue, I think, is going to surprise a lot of people, but number two certainly fits into, again, it's a Silver Age classic. It's issue number 50, Stan Lee, John Romita. Tell us why issue number 50 is your number two Spider-Man issue of all time, Mark.
There's so many elements at work here. It's personal. It's story. It's art. I mean, first of all, I did a list about a year before this one where I was just ranking my favorite covers, and this was my favorite cover, the Spider-Man No More. It's just Romita at his very, very best. I mean,
this is the issue, it's in the rain. It's in the alley. The Spider-Man costume's in the foreground and the trash can, and Peter's walking away, right?
Well, that's the interior panel, but the front cover is just the shadow specter of Spider-Man as Peter is walking towards the front of the comic with the Spider-Man No More splashed underneath him, and, you know, with this, you know, very, it's, you know, if there's ever a cover that just baits you into wanting to read what's inside, this is it. I mean, I think probably this one and, you know, it goes issue 12 where they show Spider-Man getting unmasked for the first time by Doc Ock are like probably two of the biggest baiting issues in terms of, you know, cover art as you can come up with, because it's like, what could possibly make Peter be quitting? I mean, and granted, he's talked about quitting many a times, but, you know, to have it so prominently on the front like this, and it's just, I mean, you know, like I said, the art for me just from the onset is just is spectacular. But this is an issue, and you know, this is one where I really do feel that Stan Lee kind of had a heavy hand, because it's kind of got some of that classic Stan hokum to it, but in a really neat and tidy way, where, you know, basically Peter, you know, he's met Mary Jane, he's met Gwen Stacy, he's starting, you know, he's got Harry Osborn at college, and he's basically like, you know what, it's it's not so much that I don't want to be Spider-Man anymore because of the pain and the loss and all that. I just want to be a kid. I just want to be a teenager and hang out and meet girls and you know, go to parties and all that. So I'm just going to give it up. And that's where you get that panel you were just mentioning with the garbage can, which is another great piece of artwork. And from there, you know, he's of course, you know, underneath all this, the Kingpin has his first appearance, Wilson Fisk, and crime, of course, is rising because there's no one there to stop the criminals because Spider-Man has hung it up. Peter is walking past a building where a security guard is getting mugged. And, you know, again, this is where, the Stan kind of nostalgia comes in. You know, of course, Peter gets a close look at the security guard and he reminds him of his Uncle Ben, even physically kind of looks like him. And it's this breaking point moment where Peter's like, you know, that old power and responsibility, I have to go back. I have to go do this. And, you know, there's another one of those fist bump moments where, like, you know, you're on the edge and you think that this is it. And, you know, we're never going to have another Spider-Man comic, but no, he pulls it together just in time, saves the old man, comes through for him the way he couldn't come through for his Uncle Ben. And then the last panel is him, you know, kind of, I mean, his fist is in the air, like, and then it says, Spider-Man is back. And you're just like, you know, and how, I think that's, yeah, they even wrote that, and how, which is just so fantastic.
But again, it's compressed, right? I mean, it's compressed and very effective Silver Age storytelling, because in the span of this single issue, Spider-Man decides he's going to call it quits. He calls it quits. He has his epiphany. He recovers, and he's back stronger than ever before. That's not a 12-issue arc. That's a 24-page story, right?
Exactly. Yeah, this wasn't a double issue or anything. This is you know, one regular sized issue where a lot of action happens, and you know, he's got some interplay with Gwen in there and with MJ and with Harry and you know, and again, it's creating this cast of characters, and you know, I think part of the reason why a lot of Spider-Man fans love the supporting cast so much is because, you know, there were some creative teams that went out of their way to develop Peter's relationships with them. I mean, they weren't just a bunch of background stiffs. I mean, you know, like, you know, with Gwen, I mean, there was this beautiful, charming girl, with, you know, with a brain and everything. And you're like, you're saying, as you're reading, yeah, go be with her. What's wrong with you? You know, why are you worried about your Aunt May? Go be with the girl. and it's just fun to acknowledge that. And, you know, on the personal level, you know, we had mentioned very, very early, in the podcast, Mrs. Chasing Amazing. And, for our first, wedding anniversary, which is of course the paper anniversary, and this kind of started the trend of comics as gifts, for the paper anniversary, my wife went online on her own devices, evaluated something, got something off of eBay, and you know, and gave that to me, and it's, you know, great looking copy of the book. And yeah, it was just I was kind of floored that she went through all that to do that. And I was even like, how did you even know that was an issue I wanted? And she's like, oh, we were talking, yeah, I guess we were walking somewhere in the streets of New York or something, and we walked by a comic book store or something, and she must have said something to me like, oh, what's one of your favorite covers? And I mentioned ASM 50, and she just committed that to memory months later and took care of business. And so beyond the story itself, like, you know, just obviously the circumstances of how I came to own it are very, very significant to me.
Definitely a keeper, Mark.
Definitely. <Yeah. laughs> Absolutely.
All right. Well, we've gotten to the moment now. You know, if I had a soundboard here, an engineer, I'd put in a drum roll. Maybe Mo will do that when he puts up the podcast for us. But we're going to your number one Spider-Man story of all time. Now, of course, you know, there's going to be all sorts of caveats around that. I'm sure you could pick dozens that would be your number one. This is an interesting choice. I'll let you introduce it. I'll let you defend it. Tell me why this particular issue. Tell me what the issue is and why it's your favorite.
Okay, absolutely. So number one issue is Amazing Spider-Man 300. Yes, it's not Silver Age. It's not even Bronze Age. It's 1987. I guess you would call that Copper Age.
Yeah.
David Michelinie and Todd McFarlane, the artistic superstar. And, you know, before I go any further, it is worth noting that I guess I talk enough about the significance of this issue to me on my blog that, you know, in the lead up to putting this post up on Twitter, I had a bunch of people, you know, tweet at me basically saying, this gets 300 already. I'm like, okay. So I guess I spoil things, but, you know, I mentioned 300 earlier when I was referencing 400 and actually when I was referencing, ASM 347, the other Venom issue, 300 is the first appearance of Venom, which is, you know, significant in its own right. But this is really the comic book that, that made me recognize, the incentive to collect, and specifically Spider-Man. I bought this off the spinner rack as a kid. I loved the story so much that I read my copy to a pulp. I never recovered. I mean, there are some comics I have from when I was seven that I keep in my boxes as kind of mementos of, you know, how I damaged them. This one evaporated from existence. I read it so much. I just loved the idea of this supervillain who was so much like Spider-Man. I loved McFarlane's art. It was so different and unique from anything I've ever seen in a comic book before. And I know there are some people who think McFarlane is overrated and, you know, sloppy and a mess and over stylized and overposed. And you know what? I'm not going to disagree with those people, but you know, for, you know, a kid seeing this kind of artwork in a comic book was just kind of mind boggling. And, I just remember being in high school and going to a comic book show and seeing like these dealers selling these, you know, marked up copies of their ASM 300. And I was like, wait a second, I own that. Like I bought that on the rack for $1.50, which was, you know, the double the price because it was a double issue in 1987 or was it 89? I think it's 87 when it came out. How can this be worth 100 times what I paid for it? And, you know, that kind of recognition was part of what, really made me understand that there was something to collecting. It wasn't just, you know, like, or something to comic book collecting. I mean, I knew about baseball cards and other hobbies, but, I didn't think that these little cartoon books would, you know, actually meant anything to anybody. You know, they were designed to be read, I thought. I was little. Why would I know better?
Foolish you, thinking that you're supposed to read a comic book. I mean, they're supposed to be immediately encased in plastic and kept away from prying eyes, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It might be that just like with superhero origins, comic book collections begin with some sort of terrible trauma or regret. I mean, I cut up my copy of Hulk 181 when I was a kid for the Marvel Value Stamp. And, you know, now I could see the first appearance of Wolverine and put my kids through college. What have I done? But it's interesting to me that you pick Spider-Man 300 because it is... especially with Todd McFarlane's art, who was, you know, a titan in the business and changed things and set a certain look for Spider-Man that has, you know, become classic and people still reference back to it. But it's very hermetically sealed. It's kind of a product of its age just because of that whole, you know, the Image era that followed, but all the run up to it with those guys at Marvel. And just if you look at it from a distance, I'm not sure it's aged as well as some of the other titles on your list. But it is significant with the introduction of Venom, as you mentioned, and also of significance to you personally. And I think that's why it deserves the spot at the top of your list.
Yeah, I mean, like, I you know, this might sound really silly, but I don't know if I would be a collector if this issue wasn't there when I was a kid. You know what I mean? It's that, you know, because, you know, I mean, no, I have no intentions of ever selling my collection, but, you know, you know, it's very rare that someone collects something that's worthless. You know, like why would you save something if it's disposable? And this kind of the hype with this issue, and you know, fortunately, you know, the copy I ended up getting, I got a very decent copy of it, and I did not pay a very marked up price for it, which I'm thankful for because I don't think if I tried to buy it today, I could find it in the condition I got it for in the price I paid for it. But all the same, you know, like you don't collect if something's truly, truly disposable. And this comic gave me that recognition. And you know, I just remember, you know, like it was, just, you know, I was friends with other, you know, young collectors in school, and it was a status thing if you owned this comic. It was like, oh, you got 300. I mean, it was that big of a deal, because it was Venom, it was McFarlane, it was, you know, probably of the big two, the most expensive comics that came out for our generation. I mean, you know, I know that, you know, there were other comics that came out earlier that were obviously worth more. And then, and since, you know, like the first issue of Walking Dead supposedly is priceless. And, you know, I know like the first run of Ninja Turtles is supposedly very expensive because of, you know, there's only like, you know, 30 copies or whatever the heck it was of the first printing. But, you know, in terms of a mainstream, you know, superhero comic, this was kind of the end all be all. And, you know, I don't think that comic books would be something that I'd be investing time in unless this issue gave me the recognition of what it means. And then beyond that, like I said, the villain and the art, you know, kind of sold me as a kid too. So, I mean, there was a reason why I read it so much that I destroyed it.
Well, it's been a lifelong romance, Mark, and one that's not over yet. You still have, 5 issues of Amazing Spider-Man to fill in your collection. It sounds like you're still in love with the character. You'll be reading it for the conceivable future. You know, thanks for conducting us through your list. It's been great to chat with you about Spider-Man. I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we'll ring off for the night. You've had a few months now since you've composed this list, because you wrote it in the run-up to Amazing Spider-Man 700, and you've been very patient as I've tried to get you on the show, as we've had some technical issues that delayed this interview a time or two. I know from experience that when you put together a top 10, it kind of represents a snapshot of how you're feeling at a given time. Infamously, I excluded Spider-Man from my list of top 10 Marvel heroes in one of the very first blogs I wrote at Longbox Graveyard, and I've taken some heat for that, and I'm glad for it, because it's caused me to look at the character and come to appreciate it better and make some friends, not least of which is you, Mark, as we've come to, you know, as we've bonded over Spider-Man. Looking back on this list, you know, even though it's been just a few months since you wrote it, you have any second thoughts? Are there any issues that, I know you had a list of honorable mentions, but is there anything that, in now that you've had a chance to reflect on a little bit, you feel maybe doesn't belong on the list, or something that if you could have a top 11, you know, this issue really needs to be on there, and was a painful exclusion for you?
That's a great question. I mean, I think for now the list is maintained, but yeah, those honorable mentions can kind of slide in. I mean, maybe the Juggernaut issue can, you know, hypothetically can move a little higher in the list, and you know, one of the Venom issue, that or first Venom issue I mentioned, could get bumped out for one of the honorable mentions depending on the mood. I really actually like the and I mentioned this in one of the posts I did on Longbox with the battles, the Red Skull annual number 5, where Spider-Man goes back and basically clears the name of his parents, who were thought to be, you know, communist spies or Nazi spies or, you know, spies, that's, you know, treasonous spies. They don't really specify the affiliation. But that issue kind of sneaks its way in. It could sneak its way in. And the other one of the honorable mentions it's actually another Ditko issue, which would be happy for you. It's Amazing Spider-Man 18. And it kind of ties up the loose ends from that other issue I had mentioned earlier, where Spidey runs away from the fight with the Goblin and leaves Human Torch out to dry. And in this issue, you know, it's a very Peter-centric one, and May has this speech for Peter where, you know, it kind of elevates May beyond just kind of that old woman albatross that was always getting sick and screwing things up. I mean, she basically talks about having character and gumption, which I think is just such a great word for May to be using. And it's a very, very inspiring panel. And that's one that I always could kind of see sneaking in, depending on, I guess, you know, my you know, how attuned I am to the maternal side of things in my life. You know, if I wanted to go heavy on the matriarch stuff, I could always slip that one in.
Well, maybe we'll book a date and we'll get back together in 10 years and take another look at your top 10, see how things have changed, because all these stories have been, as you
hopefully
age.
The technology will be easier.
Yeah, that's right. We'll be able to do it in some sort of holographic hookup. But, you know, as your son grows up, as you have experience as a parent, you know, everything changes your perspective as you move through life. And be curious to see how your opinion about these stories about Spider-Man changes as you continue on your own amazing quest or your amazing chase as you continue to chase these last five issues of Amazing Spider-Man. And personally, I hope the chase never ends, because I've greatly enjoyed your insights and your blog. I encourage all the readers to go check it out, www.chasingamazingblog.com. And of course, you can also find Mark on Longbox Graveyard, where he's already blogged about Spider-Man's top 10 battles, and we're hatching plans for additional columns from Mark in the future. So thanks so much, Mark, for talking to us tonight. It's been a real pleasure.
No, same here, Paul. I mean, I love the site, and I'm just very happy that we were finally able to connect and that, you know, we can make this work.
Yeah, it took a while, but it was definitely worth it. And I'll look forward to what the readers have to say about your list of top 10 Amazing Spider-Man single issues. Awesome. All right. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Mark. Thanks again to Mark Giannacchio of Chasing Amazing Blog, which can be found at www.chasingamazingblog.com. I've listed all the issues we discussed in the show notes, along with links to Mark's original blogs about them, so click a few of those links and check out Mark's thoughts. I'm sure you can tell he's a thoughtful guy and a wise authority on Spider-Man, and his blog is well worth your time. I hope you'll mouse over there and become a regular at Chasing Amazing Blog, and also keep an eye out for Mark's contributions at Longbox Graveyard. In addition to his two-part look at the top Spider-Man fights of all time, he's working on a Secret Wars piece that I hope to run in May. And I'm certainly looking forward to that. The plug of the month is for the Book Guys podcast. I've plugged them in the past. You can find them at www.bookguys.ca. But more to the point, I've put a link in my show notes to my recent guest appearance on that show. You can not only listen to me pollute someone else's podcast, you can even see my face as it happens, because there's a video feed as well. So watch it at your peril. And consider following the Book Guys show, too. They're good guys, and they deserve your support. Also, and this is not quite a plug, but I'd like to give a shout-out to my buddies Dave Ulbrich and Horace Austin, who I saw at WonderCon in Anaheim this past week. It was great to catch up with you guys. We should do it again. And, of course, I'd like to thank Mo Christensen of the We Talk Podcast Network for posting the show and his tireless support of my podcasting efforts, which, unfortunately, will be coming to a close after next month's show. That's right, the rumors are true. The May episode of the Longbox Graveyard podcast will mark 1 year that I've been doing the show, and I will be stepping away from the mic, but hopefully still visiting with you at sundry other podcasts and, of course, through my blog at www.longboxgraveyard.com. I'll go over my reasons for bringing this podcast to a close next month in my senses-shattering final issue. You stuck with me this long. I hope you'll stick with me one more month as I wrap up the experiment in terror that has been the Longbox Graveyard podcast. Until then, thanks so much for listening. Be good to each other, and I will see you in the funny papers.